Let's start with the description of the book, though, because you were saying that it's, you know, it is easy to read and so forth. Was there a conscious decision as to what format you wanted to go into and how you wanted to set it up?
There was absolutely a conscious decision. We wanted to not only raise these interesting issues, because they're some of the most controversial ones that we have, gun control, the death penalty, and all, but also to show people it's not that complicated, it's not that dry, and there's some really amazing stories behind these cases. It reads like fiction or stranger than fiction in some instances. And we had an extraordinary time traveling around the country talking to these people. So that's what we wanted to do, a different kind of book that would bring it to life more.
Who were you actually writing for?
We were writing for a general audience. Obviously, we hoped that lawyers would enjoy it too, but our main audience was a general reader. People like ourselves before we went to law school who were interested in what's going on, but don't really have a good sense of what the Bill of Rights means or how it's set up. And then I hope it'll be used perhaps in schools. We heard a seventh grader was enjoying it immensely, so that made us very happy.
Did you do any research in terms of what the general public knows about the Bill of Rights or what their feelings are?
Well, we came across a newspaper poll. It was one of the things that got us started on the book, that said that 6 out of 10 Americans can't identify the Bill of Rights. And I think that's because it's not usually presented in an interesting way. It's something that appears dry or technical or doesn't have anything to do with your daily life. But that's not true. Every time you pick up a newspaper or go to church or close the door behind you at night and you know the government's not going to barge down the door, that's the Bill of Rights. So even if you don't think about it, it's there all the time.
There are applications to the average.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We have a case, in fact, where a woman named Margarita Fuentes had her stove repossessed for non-payment. And that case actually went to the Supreme Court, because under the Fifth Amendment Due Process Clause, which says you can't be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process, the Supreme Court said you couldn't take away this woman's stove without giving her some kind of process, some kind of notice and hearing. And that they were not going to accept the government's argument that a stove or a television or a bicycle is not entitled to the same protection as your life or liberty.
There's a balance that I'm sure the framers of the Constitution and the writers of the Bill of Rights were trying to strike between personal freedoms and the responsibilities of government. Could you just address that, Tom?
Well, I think one way that that balance is really struck and tested is in the First Amendment area, which we're seeing right now. We have in our book the story of the magazine in Wisconsin that wanted to publish on its front page the secret of the H-bomb. And the government stepped up and said, no, we're going to stop the press, which you don't usually do in America. And there's a direct parallel to that case now going on in the Persian Gulf, where people are struggling with striking the balance between a free press, a free society, and national security and the lives of our troops over there.
I think there's another angle to this that might be a little more subtle in terms of the people who are gung-ho America right now. And that could also set up the knocking down of some freedoms too, don't you think?
Well, you mean if the people who are also opposed to the war have a right, their right of free speech to protest it, just as the people who are supporting it are exercising their free speech rights in supporting it. So both sides are patriotic.
Well, what I'm thinking of is more in terms of the people who are saying, this is America, you know, love it or leave it, mm-hmm. You know, it's more important to put the criminals behind bars or protect the United States against spies than it is to guarantee your personal freedoms.
Well, the Supreme Court has talked about that issue a number of times, and what they've said is that it's in times of crisis that our rights need to be protected most vigilantly, because we're willing to give them up to make a sacrifice for our country, but we actually, that's the time when we need them most, because the government it is easier for the government to try to censor or make people appear to be unpatriotic for going against the war, something like that. But that's their right of free speech, their First Amendment right which is just as precious as the other side's right to feel, you know, the way that they do. And that's exactly what we're fighting for, in a way, in the Persian Gulf. We're fighting against a dictator, and the people there have none of these rights on either side.
There's the debate about censorship and how much the military is allowing reporters to see and cover in the Gulf. Also, there's the question about the reporters who are in Baghdad and presenting, you know, Saddam's side all of the time. What's your reaction to those?
Well, they're really, I think, similar, because both situations, reporting on our military and reporting from Baghdad, raise the question of whether we're giving aid and comfort, I've heard it said, to the enemy, and compromising the national security. And this is the dilemma that we saw in the Pentagon Papers, that we saw in the H-bomb case. And it's, in fact, the only time you're going to see this kind of dilemma, because the First Amendment is so strong. And if it means anything, it means you cannot censor the press. So the only time this question will even come up is in this kind of a national security issue. And the balance has usually been struck on the side of the press. And I think that this is a step in a little bit of a different direction from the journalists that we've been talking to in terms of the control that the government has. But we've also talked to the American people who seem to support it.
I think that's because of the changing technology, which is something that the Bill of Rights has to deal with all the time. With the Pentagon Papers case, they were talking about publishing things that were 20 years old. With the H-bomb case, some of the information was out. Here we're talking about live reports from, you know, a country that we're at war with. So it's also a question of timing. We've also, this technology issue is interesting. There's a whole debate going on in the courts now about child witnesses in child abuse cases. And we interviewed two girls who were made a backyard tent in Iowa, and a man crawled in and molested them. At trial, a one-way mirror was placed between the girls and him. And which was to protect them. Now, he has a right under the Constitution to confront his accuser, and the idea behind that is that if someone's going to accuse you of something, you should be able to look them in the eye. So the screen was ruled unconstitutional. He is now free, but the courts have now realize that this is a tremendous problem for kids who have to testify in these situations. And so they have approved the use of closed-circuit TV through which the kids can testify and not have to be intimidated by the courtroom setting.
In terms of technology, I was thinking two issues. One is the DNA studies, and the other is radio telephones, wireless telephones and wiretapping. With a telephone that has a wire, law enforcement authorities have to get a subpoena, or they have to get court orders to say that they can wiretap. But with a wireless telephone, because it uses a radio between the telephone and the base, and anybody can pick that up, there's no court order needed. They can just say, well, that's, you know, use of the radio waves. Here's a case where technology has sort of, you know, gotten ahead of us. And
it happens all the time. And what you're talking about is a classic example of the Fourth Amendment wrestling with technology. The Fourth Amendment protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures, which on its face sounds like somebody rifling through your pockets or your purse. And it was not too long ago that the Supreme Court had to face just the wiretap. And it was actually a fellow in a phone booth talking to his bookie that set this precedent, and the Supreme Court finally decided that the Fourth Amendment protects people, not just places, and it protects your reasonable expectation of privacy. The word privacy doesn't appear in the Constitution, but they've now laid down the principle that the Fourth Amendment protects privacy, and then as each of these comes along, they had urinalysis testing was the first. Blood testing was actually first. Blood testing went to the Supreme Court, that's a search under the Fourth Amendment. Urine testing, that's a search under the Fourth Amendment. I don't know what DNA testing is. And they'll have to work it out, and they'll also have to work out, just as they did wiretapping and putting a bug on your car. That went to the Supreme Court. And each one is tested against the principle that we as Americans have the right to be let alone.
Now, again, this is where the, you know, the question of the greater good comes in. The blood and urine testing, of course, are with drug tests and AIDS testing. Mm-hmm. You know, and people would say, well, I have a right to go to work without having to face some junkie or have my life endangered by the AIDS.
And that, it's again, it's the privacy issue. And it's an, also a due process issue. Because you're being deprived of your liberty. If somebody has to take, it's really an invasion if somebody's going to take you aside and perform a physical test on you. On the other hand, there's a very strong argument when you're dealing with a deadly disease, or I know there's a measles issue in Philadelphia going on now, a contagious disease, that there's the public welfare, and then you have to worry about the balance.
I also wanted to talk a little bit about the right to bear arms, because I thought that you made a very good clarification about what that really means to the average American. The NRA would say one thing, but the Bill of Rights really isn't saying what they're quoting it as. Could you?
Well, the right to keep and bear arms is mentioned in the Second Amendment, and I think the people have believe or have been. There's been, as you say, an NRA campaign to people think that that means they have a constitutional right to pack a gun. But actually, the courts have never accepted that. The first part of the Second Amendment deals with the militia. So really, the debate is whether we have a right as individuals or whether the right is really on behalf of the state to raise a militia to protect us all. And the courts have overwhelmingly come down on the side that it really relates to the state's ability to raise a militia. And it goes back to what was going on at the time of the Second Amendment, which was a struggle between the federal government and the states and who would have more power. So it's really got very little to do with actually the individual and any kind of individual ownership of guns.
Was there something that you learned in researching the book, researching for the book, that surprised you?
I think that I learned that I, surprisingly, that I had much more patriotic feelings than I thought when I started really seeing what these rights meant and comparing them to other countries. It really was much more meaningful. We were in the middle of this project when all of that, when the wall came down in Berlin and democracy was sweeping across Europe. And the first thing these countries were doing was, in Czechoslovakia, I know this, they commissioned somebody to translate the American Bill of Rights. And I don't think I fully appreciated that until we were in this project and then had this dramatic example of people fighting and dying for what we have every day.
While we do have the tape running, is there something that we haven't touched on that you think is important to get out, either in terms of the book itself or in terms of the Bill of Rights and what people should know about it?
I think we've pretty well covered it. You know, I think that it's important for people to realize that it affects everybody. The Bill of Rights protects everybody, and it was written to protect the individual against the state. So it's very important, I think, for people to understand their rights and know what they can do, because these rights are there for all of us, and it's only if we understand and use them that they'll continue to protect us.
I think what I was getting at before when I was saying about the gung-ho, you know, this is America, and is this feeling that the Bill of Rights really just protects criminals?
Well, it was, as I said, written to protect the individual against the state, not just the powerful individual, but the powerless individual. And the power of the state is perhaps at its greatest against a person accused of a crime. So I think all of us are better served by criminals getting a fair trial, because it means that the system is working well for the rest of us. And I think that people do feel that way now sometimes, that criminals have too many rights, or we would all be willing to give up some of our rights in order to have safer streets. But I think if some of these rights were taken away, we would realize how much we value them. And also, I'm not sure that the Bill of Rights would be the first, you know, taking away our rights would really solve some of these other problems. I mean, there's other things I think that we could do as well.
I think we have enough.